In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
In the golden age of Hollywood, glamour could hide 1,000 secrets.
And sometimes, one of those secrets ends in murder.
I'm Erin Carlson, host of Stars of the Golden Age.
And I'm A.C. Roberts, from The Wanted Files. This is our second collaboration, and once again we're stepping into the shadows of old Hollywood, where studio scandals, silent films, and sudden violence collided. Today, we explore the life and death of William Desmond Taylor.
I will be your guide through Taylor's early life, his rise to stardom, his work, his world, and the public image he so carefully curated.
And I'll take you into the mystery, the body in the bungalow, and the lies that followed in the tangled web of suspects that still has people asking, who killed William Desmond Taylor?
First, who was William Desmond Taylor, and what did his life hold before the fateful events that led to his untimely death? William Desmond Taylor was born as William Cunningham Dean Tanner in Carlow, Ireland, on April 26, 1872. Some sources put his birth year a little later. Like his death, William's early life is sprinkled with a little mystery. William was the second of five children for parents Thomas and Jane. A major in the British Army, Father Thomas was extremely strict and possessed a fierce temper. The relationship between father and son was never jovial, and the consistent tension and disagreements resulted in William leaving home as a teenager. He went straight to the stage, and eventually, America. When his strict and controlling father learned of his son's acting endeavors, he was furious. No son of his would be an actor. His sons were expected to do masculine things with their lives. Masculine in his eyes, that is. So Thomas arranged to send his teenage son to the Runnymede Ranch in Kansas, a facility, quote, focused on transforming rebellious youth into refined gentlemen farmers. After William's 18-month stay at the ranch, he was still unclear on his life's trajectory. He dabbled in a variety of different jobs, such as waiting tables, door-to-door magazine sales, and working on the railroad. Eventually, he landed in New York City, smack dab in the theater scene. His father had tried, but he was not going to be able to keep his son away from show business. The vibrant New York theater scene was where William found love as well. On December 7th, 1901, William married Ethel May Harrison, a beautiful stage actress from an affluent family. They were soon expecting a baby, so Ethel retired from acting to become a mother and homemaker. William's theater income was far from adequate and reliable, so, with the help of his father-in-law's connections, and wallet, he stepped into the role of managing a New York City antique store, The Antique Shop on Fifth Avenue. Little Ethel Daisy was born a little over a year after the couple was married. William found himself settled into a pretty good life, a beautiful wife, a healthy baby girl, and a great job that he ended up having quite a flair for. But he still felt unsettled. Maybe it was all just too concrete. Maybe this kind of stable life just wasn't for him. He maybe needed more variety and excitement. Whatever the reasoning behind it, William began drinking heavily and engaging in numerous affairs. On September 26, 1908, just shy of 7 years into this good life, William took $600 from the antique store, gave $500 of it to a store employee with instructions to deliver it to his wife, took the remaining $100, and disappeared from life as he knew it. Without a word of explanation, William walked away from his wife and 5-year-old daughter and disappeared. William effortlessly stepped back into his vagabond lifestyle, drifting across the United States, taking on a series of short-term jobs. And then his next big venture was gold. He, like so many others, dreamed of hitting it big in gold. So he spent some time prospecting for gold in both Colorado and Alaska. Unsuccessfully. William just couldn't seem to find his calling, if there was even a calling to be found. But there was one thing that kept creeping back into his soul. The stage. He finally landed in San Francisco and returned to a life in the theater. And that led him to the brand new entertainment thrill sweeping the nation. Silent films. Next stop, Hollywood. And with this transition, William Cunningham Dean Tanner became William Desmond Taylor. A new persona for a new life in Hollywood. William's estranged wife and daughter happened to see a movie that William appeared in, much to Ethel's shock and surprise. Now knowing what became of the husband who abandoned her and their daughter, she took the high road and made sure that he was able to reform a relationship with his daughter. Ethel had remarried and she needed nothing from William, but she did this solely for the emotional well-being of their daughter. It didn't take long in Hollywood for William to realize he was more interested in filmmaking behind the scenes than acting out the roles in front of the camera. When a directorial position became available at Balboa Studio, William jumped on the opportunity. His directorial debut was The Awakening in the fall of 1914. Balboa Studio didn't survive this mad dash of early filmmaking, but William Desmond Taylor did. From Balboa, he joined the American Film Company, and then to Famous Players Lasky. Soon, he was a very successful film director with hit after hit to his credit. Between 1914 and 1922, William directed over 60 films. Although flying high in Hollywood, William put his career on hold in the summer of 1918 to enlist in the Canadian Expeditionary Force, offering his services in the final months of World War I. He trained for 4 months in Nova Scotia before sailing to England and being assigned to the Royal Army Service Corps in Dunkirk. He rose the ranks to major, just as his father had done. He returned to Hollywood about 6 months after the end of World War I in May of 1919. By early 1922, 49-year-old William Desmond Taylor was considered one of Hollywood's finest and most sought-after film directors, and he was the head of the Motion Picture Directors Association. He did not speak of his past, just that he had done a little stage work in New York and San Francisco. The real work, the serving tables, the door-to-door sales, the gold mining, the family. He kept those lives carefully tucked away under lock and key. Another secret William Desmond Taylor kept close to him was his intimate relationships with men. He was reportedly a member of a homosexual society club and would partake in the occasional opium party within those circles. One of Taylor's closest friends was his production manager. 24-year-old George James Hopkins. According to Hopkins, he and William Desmond Taylor had a long, quote, affair of the heart, discreet but passionate, end quote. This, like so many other personal aspects of his life, was kept a closely guarded secret to the outside world. William Desmond Taylor was a mysterious man in so many ways. Very private and very mysterious. William Desmond Taylor's life was grand. He was successful and wealthy. He called Alvarado Court in Westlake Park his home. His residence was one of 8 large Spanish-inspired bungalows, each divided as a duplex, that encircled a beautifully landscaped courtyard garden at the center. His Alvarado Court neighbors included other high-profile directors and actors. In those early days of 1922, aside from his very discreet intimate relationship with George Hopkins, he also enjoyed a close relationship with actress Mabel Normand. He also had a brand new assistant, or valet as it was more commonly called then, named Henry Peavy, who he was very pleased with. His former assistant had robbed him while he was away in England about 6 months prior, making away with $5,000, expensive jewelry and clothing, and totaling his car. But things were going very well with Henry Peavy. However stable life appeared, under the surface were some difficulties that William became attached to by association. First, Mabel Normand was battling a severe cocaine addiction, and William had devoted himself to supporting her through it, including at least one confrontation with her drug dealer. The relationship between William and Mabel was one based on respect and intellectual enrichment. This was the kind of relationship Mabel needed to get herself back on track, and it seemed to be working. Second, his assistant, Henry Peavy, was a gay black man, which, sadly, was not a good position to be in 1922 America. Police would take any opportunity they could to arrest either a black man or a gay man, and Henry was both. During the last week of January 1922, Henry Peavy was arrested in the park for vagrancy and indecent proposal, simply for being a black gay man talking to another gay man. The Westlake Park was a common place in those days for gay people to meet each other, but police had started putting heavy force on those situations. Henry Peavy's employer, William Desmond Taylor, bailed him out of jail after this incident, posting his $200 bond, and insisted on testifying for him at a scheduled hearing on February 2nd. Peavy said his boss was a very good and very kind man. William didn't have to help either of those individuals, Mabel or Henry, but he chose to. In the coming months, neighbors would reflect on some occurrences that were out of the ordinary in their quiet and secluded Alvarado Park courtyard neighborhood. One neighbor claims to have seen a figure looking into the windows of William Desmond Taylor's bungalow. Another observed 2 men trying to gain access through the front door before lingering for a long while. Taylor wasn't known to receive guests too frequently, so these incidents really stood out. Stood out, but not acted upon. Those close to William also observed his behavior to be a little off in those early weeks of 1922. Always cool and reserved, he seemed to be on edge. Something seemed to be bothering him and causing him some inner turmoil. Yet, he didn't tell anyone what that turmoil might be. Valet Henry Peavy left William at his home around dusk on February 1st, 1922, just as he did every other day. Shortly later, Mabel Normand paid William a visit. William had purchased a couple of books for her as a gift, so she stopped by to retrieve them. William was happy to see Mabel, and he appeared to be much more relaxed from his recent tense demeanor. As they said their goodbyes, William helped Mabel into her coat and walked her out to her car, leaving his front door wide open, as he always did. At her car, with her chauffeur ready to drive her home, William kissed Mabel goodbye. She gently pulled on his earlobe and happily said, "Toodaloo, Billy," before entering the car. "As my car turned around, I waved at him," Mabel recalled. "I looked back and we wafted kisses on our hands to each other for as long as I could see him standing there." The time was 7:45 p.m. Mabel Normand was the last person to see William Desmond Taylor alive.
February 2, 1922, Westlake, Los Angeles. The morning sun was still climbing when William Desmond Taylor's valet, Henry Peavy, arrived at his employer's bungalow, just like he had done every other day. But this time, something was off. The front door was ajar. The house was quiet. Too quiet. And then, he saw him. William Desmond Taylor was lying on the floor, face up, fully dressed. His legs were straight, his arms at his side. There was no blood, no sign of struggle. At first, Peavy and a neighbor believed Taylor had suffered a heart attack. It wasn't until hours later, when police arrived, that someone noticed the dark, small wound beneath his jacket. He had been shot. In the back, one time, execution style. The bullet had passed cleanly through his chest. Whoever killed him had done it quietly, a single shot, expertly placed. Not one neighbor reported hearing the sound that killed him. In the hours after Taylor's body was discovered, people began pouring into the bungalow. Not just police, but studio executives, publicists, and the simply curious. And somewhere in that flood of visitors, things began to disappear. Papers from Taylor's desk were quietly removed. His personal letters and documents were gone. By the time detectives secured the scene, much of what might have told them what really was had already vanished. Some claimed a man posing as a doctor examined the body and left before police arrived. Others said Paramount sent quote-unquote cleaners to protect the studio's image. The body was removed, the bungalow locked, and Hollywood had its first true murder mystery. A rising star struck down in silence by someone who walked in, unnoticed, and left without a trace. The news of William Desmond Taylor's death spread faster than the police could build a case. By the afternoon, crowds had gathered outside the bungalow. Photographers, columnists, gawkers, everyone wanted a glimpse of the scene or a whisper of the scandal, and they got both. It was quickly revealed that Taylor was not who he claimed to be. As Aaron mentioned, the man born William Cunningham Dean Tanner had left his family in his previous life in New York, changed his name, and reinvented himself in Hollywood. No one questioned this. Not until he was dead. Police began to reconstruct the timeline. On the night of February 1st, neighbors reported seeing Taylor at home around 7:45 p.m. Shortly before that, Mabel Normand, a popular comedic actress and close friend of Taylor's, had stopped by for a brief visit. Some say they were close friends. Others believe there was something more. Henry Peavy said they had laughed, spoke briefly, and then he walked her to her car. It was the last time anyone saw Taylor alive. At some point later in the evening, someone entered his home. No signs of forced entry, no sign of a robbery, just one clean shot and a body left neatly behind. The investigation into William Desmond Taylor's death began with promise, but it didn't take long for things to go sideways. When police searched Taylor's body, they found a few personal items: $78 in cash, a silver cigarette case, a pocket watch, a penknife, and a locket containing a photo of Mabel Normand. But something was missing. The day before his death, Taylor had shown his accountant a much larger sum of money, money that was now gone. It raised the question, did the killer come for more than just revenge? The timeline placed Taylor's murder around 7:50 p.m., shortly after Mabel Normand left his home. But after that, the trail went cold, fast. And then came the suspects. The first was Edward Sands, Taylor's former valet and cook. He had a history of theft, forgery, and breaking into Taylor's home. Sands had stolen Taylor's car, forged his checks, and vanished before the murder, but no one could find him afterward. His role remains a question mark to this day. Then there was Henry Peavy, the valet who discovered the body. Some pointed fingers at him because of his eccentric mannerisms and a previous lewd conduct charge, but no real evidence ever connected him to the crime. Peavy was dragged through the press, but ultimately cleared by investigators. Then there's Mary Miles Minter, an innocent ingenue, blonde, baby-faced, and only around 19 at the time of the murder. She had starred in several of Taylor's films and was deeply infatuated with him. Letters from Mary to Taylor found after his death were intimate, emotional, and at times desperate. In one, she wrote, quote, "My love for you is so great, I cannot live without you." The tone of the letters raised eyebrows, but Taylor reportedly didn't reciprocate. He was 49 years old. She was barely out of childhood. When those letters were leaked to the press, Mary's image as the virginal screen darling collapsed. The public saw obsession. But again, no evidence tied her to the murder either. But Mary wasn't the only one obsessed with control, or the only one police should have been watching. Charlotte Shelby was Mary's mother, and in many ways her manager, her warden, and her greatest liability. She was notoriously controlling, jealous, fiercely protective of her daughter's reputation and her earnings. Charlotte didn't approve of Taylor as a romantic interest. She feared he was getting too close to Mary, or worse, cutting her out of Mary's future. And according to some reports, Charlotte owned a small pistol, the same caliber bullet used to kill William Desmond Taylor. But the gun was never found, the connection never confirmed, and Charlotte lawyered up and walked away untouched. Three women, three very different relationships, each pulled into the vortex of suspicion. Minter's love letters fed public scandal, and Charlotte's rumored pistol fit the possible murder weapon. Theories bloomed like smoke. Some whispered it was a studio cover-up. Others pointed to a love triangle gone wrong. And still, more believed it was a message, a professional hit carried out in silence and meant to stay unsolved. But if that was the plan, the aftermath failed spectacularly. Because William Desmond Taylor's murder didn't disappear, it exploded. The press dissected his past, the studios panicked over his secrets, and the three women, each tied to Taylor in a different way, became the center of suspicion. There were no fingerprints, no murder weapon, no sign of a struggle, so the investigation turned to motive. But the bigger problem wasn't the suspects, it was the investigation itself. From the moment Taylor's body was found, the crime scene became a circus. Studio executives and publicists arrived before detectives. Some helped themselves to Taylor's personal letters and documents, removing anything that might fuel more scandal. By the time the police sealed the bungalow, it was already too late. The scene was contaminated. The evidence was compromised. And Hollywood's damage control was already in motion. In the end, the investigation stalled. Detectives pointed fingers at each other. Witnesses clammed up. And some reports suggest the district attorney's office was pressured to let the case fade quietly from view. Files went missing, suspects stopped cooperating, and over time the story shifted from a murder to a mystery, one Hollywood would never solve. Hollywood didn't just have a murder on its hands, it had a public relations disaster. William Desmond Taylor wasn't just a director, he was clean, respected, a vocal critic of the scandals plaguing early film. Especially after the Fatty Arbuckle case had already shaken the industry to its core. You may remember Fatty Arbuckle from the case Aaron and I covered before. And now here was William Desmond Taylor, dead in his home, a man with a secret past, a circle of famous women, and a bullet in his back. The studios couldn't afford another scandal, so they did what the studios did best. They rewrote the story. In the hours after Taylor's body was found, executives from Paramount Pictures arrived at the bungalow. Some say they were there to comfort friends. Others say they were there to clean up loose ends. There were reports that personal papers, private letters, and photographs were removed from Taylor's desk before police took over the scene. A man posing as a doctor may have examined the body and quietly left. Key details of Taylor's double life, his abandoned wife and daughter, his prior identity never made it into the early police reports. By the time detectives were fully in control, the scene had already been contaminated. Not by violence, but by reputation management. The press, of course, had no such filter. Tabloids had a field day. Taylor's personal life, his sexuality, his female acquaintances, all were dissected on front page headlines. Whispers of drug use, blackmail, even secret affairs flooded gossip columns nationwide. The case became less about justice and more about narrative control. And somewhere in the middle of all that noise, the facts got quieter, the evidence got colder, and the killer, whoever they were, got away. Whoever killed William Desmond Taylor did it up close. One shot in the back, no struggle, no hesitation. This kind of violence isn't chaotic, it's controlled. This wasn't a rage killing, it was personal, it was precise. And whether it came from obsession, fear, or protection, the person who pulled the trigger likely believed they were solving a problem, silencing a secret, reclaiming power in a world where image was everything. Was it a jealous mother, a scorned lover, a studio fix gone too far? Imagine, the door opens. Maybe it's someone he knows, so he doesn't flinch. They talk. Maybe he lets them in. Then as he turns away, a gun raised from behind, one clean shot. The body left posed, deliberate, no panic. Then, footsteps, out the door. Gone before anyone even knows what happened. A perfect silence for a man who once built his life on performance.
William Desmond Taylor was more than a Hollywood mystery. He was a man with a past, a career on the rise, and a mysterious life filled with secrets.
His death revealed the cracks in Hollywood's golden image, where secrets were protected, scandals cleaned, and truth rewritten before it ever reached the front page.
In the end, the spotlight faded. The suspects vanished into silence, and the case was quietly closed without ever being solved.
Because sometimes the most powerful story in Hollywood is the one they never finished writing.
You've been listening to a special crossover episode of Stars of the Golden Age and The Wanted Files. I'm Erin Carlson, and I'll be back soon with more stories from the golden era of film.
And I'm AC Roberts. For more cold cases, strange disappearances, and stories that still demand answers, follow The Wanted Files wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't forget to rate, review, and share so these stories are not forgotten.
Until next time, stay curious, stay safe, and take care of yourselves and each other.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter interior paint is a paint and primer in one with a tough, lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.